Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And, you know, every so often, I'm just so impressed. Well, I'm always impressed with the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. But they have this segment called Parallel Stories. And if you haven't been, if you haven't attended, you guys need to go because it's so interesting. They bring like-minded voices into the conversation, usually both are artists in their own way. And on November 17th at 2:30, we've got the museum presenting parallel stories, breaking the cycle, rewriting the story. And they are featuring artist Narciso Martinez and writer Alex Espinosa. They both have a really interesting idea about how to present a narrative. And so the talk is going to be about how to present a narrative. And I want to introduce Narciso to the show. Narciso is a relatively young artist who came to the United States. It's a really interesting story, fascinating story. He came to the United States when he was 20 years old. He attended a community adult school and completed high school. Completed high school fairly well, older than most people do, and then won an Associate of Arts degree from Los Angeles City College. Then he kept on going on. He went in 2012 to the California State University, Long Beach, to earn a Bachelor of Fine Arts. And then, you know, he took up drawing and painting while he pursued his degree. And sure enough, he was awarded the Daedalus Foundation Master MFA Foundation Fellowship in Painting and Sculpture. At this point, he started to show locally and internationally. And today, he's in the collections of MFA Houston, LACMA, Buffalo AKG Museum, Hammer Museum, Amon Carter Museum of American Art, and many other university museums and established galleries, et cetera. He lives and works in Los Angeles, and he's currently represented by Charlie James Gallery. And I looked up a couple of things that he's done in his career. Very interesting. He's dedicated his artistic practice to depicting and elevating the labor of his fellow farm workers. Now, what does that mean? And I will bring you to this conversation by saying Martinez is establishing himself through his visual language as a farm worker and an artist himself. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And I was looking at a mural that I thought was so interesting called Always Fresh. And I thought, oh, that is so interesting, Always Fresh. And it refers to the farm worker, the laborer, et cetera, but it's absolutely beautiful. And I'm so thrilled to be talking with Narciso. So I want to know, Narciso, you know, to me, when I look at the mural, Always Fresh, your mural, that's in the Buffalo AKG Art Museum. I think of portraiture. I think of 18th century portraiture in a way. And I think of very formal presentation of the person and figural study. I want to know where you got this language from and how it serves you in your voice representing marginalized farm workers. Tell me more.
Well, thank you for this space. I actually work in the field speaking produce since I started undergraduate studies, probably like in around 2009. And I did that all the way throughout my undergrad and graduate studies, which I finished in 2018. And I feel like at the beginning it was more about the money, but towards the end, because of the nature of the program, I had to focus on concepts. So I had to write a paper. And that's when sort of like when I realized that I was part of that community, like I was struggling the same way they were struggling. We share similar stories with the farm workers. I'm talking about my coworkers. And I really connected with them. And I just realized I was part of that community. And I also realized how unfair their situation is, because still is. When it comes to like wages and opportunities and even working conditions or treatment in the jobs. And because I've always been kind of shy in my life, I thought that I could, by drawing about these individuals, I could speak about those stories and those sort of like issues. And that's sort of like what led me to draw and depict people who work in the fields.
I think it's absolutely beautiful. It's so interesting to me that you often used reclaimed produce boxes as your support. Very interesting to me. Unexpected. And, you know, by doing this, you're drawing attention to, you know, what the workers are actually doing in the field. And it's interesting, you come from a family of six siblings, and you wanted a college degree. So you finished high school at the age of 29, as I was saying, a little older than most high school people. And you began working seasonally in the apple orchards of Eastern Washington State while you were continuing a Master of Fine Arts. This must have been such a contrast for you, but in a way you turned it into a life's work. So can you tell me, what were some of the experiences you had as a worker in the field where you say, you know, that these people like yourself, you didn't get what you deserve. Can you tell me more?
Definitely. I mean, for starters, I remember the first produce that I picked was asparagus, and asparagus grows on the ground. So picking anything that grows on the ground, I feel like it's harder than anything else, because people have to be bent over most of the time to pick the produce. That for me was like, almost did not want me to continue doing this anymore, because it's really backbreaking. I remember the wage was really low. I remember complaining to my brother because I didn't know anybody else but my brothers. And so I saw a lot of people working in a circle of asparagus where only a few porta potties were provided. And sadly, I feel like women had the worst at that time that I can remember. I remember my brother complaining about the bathrooms to the manager. I don't know what's the deal within the administration, I guess, of the orchards, but but I remember I don't know if I should say this because it's like sort of like personal, but all I can say is that women had to had it difficult because there was only one or two porta potties for like a lot of people, and I feel like women have different needs than men, and I can't believe that they were just struggling just to get those basic needs, to have some kind of decent place to
to relieve themselves.
Right. And as women, they sometimes have their periods and they have to go through other needs, and it was just hard, and it's unfortunate. But things of that nature happens in the field. People passed out from the heat. People fall from the ladders many times. I've witnessed that many times where people fall from the ladders and because people are running around, whether in picking apples or cherries. People many times fell on top of other people. It's just hard. And on top of that, a lot of the times people are pressured to work, even when they are working by the hours, they are pressured to work certain amount of work. They even have these signals where people have to get to that line in order for them to either get hired the following day or even get paid. And it's just sad. And I feel like there is no somebody who's like looking after that, you know, like there's no like, yeah, people who can, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, but people who can be behind those and make sure regulation, I guess, and make sure these people get the right and fair treatment in the fields. That's kind of sad. Many of them are undocumented. And because of that, a lot of the orchards take advantage of that. When they get injured, many times they don't say anything because of the retaliation. When somebody got injured, they would be like, they wouldn't say anything. I actually got injured. I fell from a tree and I didn't say anything. I was in pain for like forever, many years. But it's just that fear of like, maybe they're not going to give me a job the next day of the next season if I complain. And it certainly happens. They can have, let's say, it's hard for them to get a driver's license because sometimes they can't prove that they live there or that they live in there for more than 3 years. People share living spaces, so it's hard for people sometimes to get a proof that they actually live in that area. Many times they can they can buy a house because they don't have documents, or they can they don't speak the language. There's no schools around that they can go and learn the language. It's just like so many disadvantages, I guess. They can't travel to visit their parents in other countries. It they have it really difficult. And I feel like they do a really, really hard job, like breaking back job, and to literally get the food that we eat. So those are the things that I can remember for only working in that period of time.
Well, that's, I just cannot wrap my head around that kind of treatment of people. And I'm so glad when I was looking at your work, I was thinking, you know, thank God somebody's saying something visually about this, because that's you, Narcissus. So, you know, Richard, let's go to quick break. We get back from the break. The topic of parallel stories is breaking the cycle and rewriting the story. And so I want to know what breaking the cycle might mean to Narciso. And I also want to ask about this really interesting question of identity. So as an artist, he's presenting the identity of his subjects through his work. And so I want to know what this visual identity, what the clues are, you know, behind what he's doing, what he's painting. And again, this is celebrating our wonderful museum, Santa Barbara Museum of Art. Speaking of parallel stories, this is an award-winning artist presentation and writers and all sorts of interesting people that come and talk to us about a similar topic. And the topic here is identity. Alex Espinosa and Narciso Martinez talking about identity in very different ways. Alex, who writes about identity through his novels, and Narciso, who paints about identity in gorgeous works. And this is a very important topic we're talking about, which is Narciso's understanding of the farm worker and how he's brought that plight to us visually speaking. So don't turn that down. Back in a minute with Narciso. Richard, let's go to quick break. Okay, Alex is coming. Hello, Richard, are we? Okay, we're back. This is Elizabeth Stewart, and I have the great honor of speaking with a wonderful artist, Narciso Martinez. And the reason that I wanted to cover this is I really loved his work, and also I loved his message. So he came to this country when he was 20 years old, got his high school degree at 29, and kept on going through all of his work and continuing on graduate work, et cetera. The time he was being educated, he himself was a farm worker, laborer in the fields. And he told an interesting story at the beginning of the hour where he said, you know, here I was at school and at this, working on an MFA, and I was in the fields. So there was such a disconnect because I had to write papers, and I thought, well, okay, why doesn't my subject be the farm workers, me, myself? And that was when this whole work, I guess, was birthed. A life's work was birthed at that point. And I wanted to know this idea of breaking the cycle. The title of the talk that Alex and Narciso will be doing is Breaking the Cycle, Rewriting the Story. How does your work, Narciso, how does it break the cycle?
I feel like for me, breaking the cycle has to start within me. And for me, I feel like it was literally breaking the cycle within my family, and I saw that within my community.
Yes.
Because back in Oaxaca, I went to school in Oaxaca. I'm from Oaxaca, Mexico. And I only went through eighth grade, and my grades were really low. So I failed more than three classes when I was like around ninth grade. So I got actually kicked out of high school. And when I came to the United States, I first got interested in education through the language, because I kind of wanted to know what the culture was, what the movies or the songs were about. So I went to adult school to learn the language. And when I was going through the ESL program, that's when I got into taking high school classes. And I realized that I was able to actually have good grades. And I remember going back and literally starting to learn how to divide or subtract with little rocks. And I understood it from the beginning. And at one point, I thought I could actually do this. I was not this kid who had all these low grades and who failed to so many classes. I actually knew and actually got interested in learning. So that pushed me to finish high school. And at that time, like I said, I was almost 30 years old. And in my family, all my siblings got married like so young, and they're maybe early 20s, maybe 18, some of them. And for me, being single at 29 was, for my family, was like very shocking. Let's say they were actually pushing me, when are you going to get married, and like all this pressure building up. But I would see myself at that time, I was working at different jobs, like bussing tables and washing cars and loading and unloading trucks. And I thought of my life, like having a family and doing these kind of jobs. I was like, I don't think I want to have a family if I have this kind of job where I live day by day, borrowing money here and there to pay my rent. And I thought, I want a career. I don't know what career, I didn't know what to study, but I want an education. To me, that was breaking the cycle. I wanted to break the cycle in my family, not only in education, but also in understanding my surroundings, the system, and not following the tradition of you have to get married and have family. Because, you know, you should do it when you're ready, not only because the culture dictates it.
Breaking the cycle for you meant that you broke from your family. That is so interesting. And it's also, you know, I just thought that the work I was seeing, I mean, when I hear your story and I think, oh, here Narciso he wanted a career. Well, now he's in the best museums of the world. You got a career.
Thank you.
Your career is, you know, is creating a voice, and you have created that voice. Speaking of voice, popping into our studio is Alex Espinoza, who's the partner with Narciso on the talk Parallel Stories, Breaking the Cycle and Rewriting the Story. And I want to introduce Alex to the show. Alex is a queer writer, and he has written many, many books. I looked at them all, and they're all so interesting. We'll talk a little bit about this. His debut novel was Stillwater Saints, and it was published to wide critical acclaim. And I'll tell you what some of the reviewers have to say about that. His second novel, Five Acts of Diego Leon, was the winner of the 2014 American Book Award from Before Columbus Foundation. Other awards include fellowship from the Breadloaf Writers Conference and the National Endowment for the Arts and the McDowell. He's the author of the nonfiction book Cruising, an intimate history of a radical pastime. He's written essays, reviews, and stories for the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, Virginia Quarterly Review, Los Angeles Times, Lit Hub, and NPR. His short story, Detainment, was selected for inclusion in the 2022 Best American Mystery and Suspense Stories. He lives in Los Angeles with his husband, Kyle. He teaches at the University of California, Riverside, and he is the Tomas Riviera Endowed Chair and Professor of Creative Writing. And we are talking today specifically about the new novel called The Sons of El Rey, published in June of 2024 from Simon & Schuster. And I welcome Alex to the show. And Alex, you're quoted as saying that the top of the quote that press release about Parallel Stories on November 17th, writing and storytelling were a kind of escape from the violence and poverty I saw and experienced around me growing up. They were an opportunity for me to step out of my environment and create alternate worlds. So in the new novel, The Sons of El Rey, the alternate world that is created is actually a three-layered world. And I wanted to ask you, as I was reading the reviews and I was reading the pricey, I wanted to know, what was the inspiration? So I have to just, a little spoiler alert, for people who haven't picked up the novel. El Rey is one of those fighters that you see with the Mexican fighters with the mask and, you know, the real, like, macho kind of, almost like, I could say like a rocker outfit, you know, like a Kiss outfit, you know, it's they're like, rock musicians, and they raise themselves to the level of great heroes. And it would seem to me to come off of the light of, you know, Five Acts of Diego Leon and Cruising, an intimate history of a radical pastime, that this was kind of a departure. Alex, can you tell us more about this creation, this character creation? Yeah.
Thank you for that. And also, it's great to be here with you and with Narciso, whose art and imagery I've followed and know very well. So it's an honor to be here and to have this opportunity to talk. I think that, like so many of us, I think I explore the interplay between identities, you know, the idea that as Mexicanos, as Latinos, Latinas, we're always wearing masks or actually being forced to by sometimes our different cultural expectations or backgrounds. So this book, in terms of like what I explore, it really was no different than what I've always explored in all of my writing, is this idea of queerness, this idea of, the brown immigrant body being seen as either a source of labor or a source of fetishization. I'm sorry. In terms of its sort of role, you know, the spectacle of sort of sexuality and violence that usually our bodies, our brown bodies, are succumbed to when it comes to the sort of larger American economy and its need to consume, right?
I knew you were going to say consume.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and looking at Narciso's work, like it does the same thing, and that like it sort of highlights these people and these lives that I think oftentimes we consider expendable. We consider, less than, and I think our capitalist society oftentimes, both loves us and needs us, but also hates us at the same time. And that's always what I've explored in my work, is that I've always wanted to highlight these communities, these people, these experiences that oftentimes I think get misrepresented in larger, mainstream media.
I think it's so interesting that you're talking about consuming and consumption. You know, when I was looking at Narciso's work and some of the museums that that he's hanging in, and one particular piece is installed at the Buffalo AKG Art Museum. Before you came on, Alex, I was talking about this particular large mural. It's called Always Fresh. It's from 2018. Absolutely gorgeous. And it has to do with the act of picking our food, what we consume. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also interesting because the El Rey Coyote, he is actually, you think of this idea of the body being consumed as well. You know, mm-hmm. there he is in his cape and his mask, and the body is actually being consumed, and how that body image then passes down through two generations more. Mm-hmm. But here again, I'm not getting complete an answer to my question, which is, what inspired you to do this particular topic? In other words, this idea of the wrestlers that don these incredible flamboyant masks and capes. And they're daredevils and they're rock stars.
Yeah.
What drew you to this kind of character?
Well, actually, it was back in 2013 when my second novel basically tanked, right? It was published and, was kind of a little bit of a failure.
Which one was that?
The Five Acts of Diego León.
But it's no longer a failure, right?
Well, I mean, it didn't sell very well, and my publisher didn't do much to push it. So I was in a bit of a slump, and I was a little angry, and I didn't want to become a casualty of the sort of larger publishing machine. So and around the same time, I saw someone. Who was a, East Coast white WASPy writer who sold a book and got tons and tons and tons of money. And it was about three generations of an Irish American family in Brooklyn. And it was kind of a bit of a joke. I actually talked with my partner and I said, ha, 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 wouldn't it be funny if I wrote three generations of a Mexican American family? Like no one would pay me $1 million for that. And then I thought, well, what other like cheesy kind of Mexican trope could I throw in there? And I thought, well, Loteria has been done, like the Loteria cards, like people have written stories around each character in the card. Of course, we all know La Llorona. And I thought, Lucha Libre, let me try that. And then I sort of sat, I thought jokingly, and I sat with it for a little while and actually realized that there was a lot that I could say about bodies and about gender and about masculinity. So that's kind of how it came about, actually, was kind of, I was angry and kind of a little cynical, to be honest. And that's what I wrote.
I think that's fantastic. I mean, that is more of an answer than I ever expected. that is absolutely wonderful. And this idea that, this captured your attention, but then it became a metaphor for something very deep So it was a joke at first, and then it's okay, now this is actually talking about identity and mask and body and consumption and sacrifice and generational trauma. How did that happen? That wasn't a joke. That's fantastic. Richard's giving us the hand signal that we got to go to quick break. So if you will just bear with me, dear listener, I want to just give another shout out. I have the great honor of speaking with Alex Espinoza and Narciso Martinez, two wonderful artists, both in their own right. Narciso is, of course, a painter, visual artist. Alex is a narrative artist, a writer, and they are going to be talking at our museum November 17th at 2:30 in Parallel Stories, Breaking the Cycle and Rewriting the Story. We talked with Narciso a little bit about how he was approaching breaking the cycle. And I'd love to ask Alex the same question. In his life, how did he feel that he broke the cycle? I want to know when we get back from the break. Hey, Richard, quick break. Welcome back, two wonderful people right now on the show with me today, Alex Espinoza. Some of his novels, and I just want to do a quick overview because I want to ask him a really important question that relates to the trajectory and the themes of these novels I'm going to talk about. He will be talking with Narciso on November 17th about breaking the cycle and rewriting the story. Let's just talk a little bit about cruising, an intimate history of a radical pastime. This is the timeless art. Now, this is, I think, a genius stroke. A timeless art of cruising for a hookup and the political and cultural forces behind this. And he goes back in this book to Greek antiquity. He goes back to the molly houses of the 18th century in England. He goes into the 1970s here. And the algorithms of Grindr. He talks about George Michael and Oscar Wilde. And cruising is, and I made myself a little chart, cruising equals a powerful rebuke to patriarchy and capitalism. And so he drew that conclusion, having looked at the historical background of cruising. Then, you know, this novel that he's describing is not popular when it came out, I think. It sounds to me like the novel that I want to pick up and read a couple of times. It's The Five Acts of Diego León. So this is a Mexican-born, turns out he's going to be an actor in his future life, but he's Mexican-born in a small village during the Mexican Revolution, which is a fantastic time. We've covered a number of speakers about the revolution here on this program, and I find it so interesting. It was one, I tell you, Alex, who talked about the role of women in the revolution. That was her dissertation, and it was just absolutely fabulous hour. He learns a profession, or Diego is supposed to be learning a profession from his grandparents, and he flees Mexico because he doesn't want this profession. And he comes to Hollywood in 1927. And of course, that's an auspicious year because, you know, in 1929, we have the speaking films breaking through. And we've got in that year talkies, prohibition. But what he's discovered as is the Latin lover type. And he becomes a star. But the thing I really like about this is that he's an underdog hero. And I love that switch that you've done with your main character. And then Stillwater Saints was his debut novel. And it's about California Inland Empire, east of Los Angeles and west of the desert. My gosh, I've been there many times. Teachers, construction workers, middle managers, shoplifters, Chicana muralists, tattoo artists. And this is centering around a shop, a botanica And the Britannica, strangely enough, is named Ocean. Ocean. And Ocean, Richard, you're gonna love this one. You know what Ocean is? Okay, Alex, I'll give you a clue. I was in the Peace Corps in Nigeria for 3 years.
Oh, okay.
So the minute I saw Ocean, it was like, okay,
well, you know.
It's the Yoruba goddess of love and fertility mm-hmm. and abundance. And she takes a lot of different formats in that culture, in the Yoruba culture. I lived it right on the edge of the tribal area of the Yoruba.
Mm.
And I taught music, which was an absolute travesty. Can you believe it? Send a nice white girl to teach music to the African. I mean, of all, you know, what do you call it? Superciliousness that you could possibly, you know, encounter. But in any way, I digress. And so now just a very quick précis about the new book, Son of El Rey. So Ernesto and Elena Vega arrive in Mexico City. Ernesto works on a construction site. He's discovered by a local lucha libre trainer. And this is Mexican style wrestling with the fabulous mask, et cetera. And he realizes that he can find fame as El Rey Coyote, and he gains name recognition across Mexico. And then years later in East Los Angeles, Freddy Vega is struggling to save his father's gym as a son, while Freddy's own son, Julian, is searching for professional and romantic fulfillment as a Mexican-American gay man. And now Ernesto El Rey is dying, and he's leaving Freddie and Julian to find their own passions and discover what happened in Mexico. Tell us what happened in Mexico, Alex.
I don't think I can tell you without giving the plot away.
Just a little hint. I don't want to give it away either, but a little hint.
I think it's what happens in Mexico before before they arrive in the U.S. is a lifetime of, I think, secrets and forbidden love that transcend not just time but borders. And that was ultimately what I was hoping to try to achieve. This idea that for so many of us, you know, Mexico remains a country of deep mystery, half-truths. A lot of times we get bits of information about what happened over there, you know, allá, but we don't get the full answer. And I sort of wanted to explore that idea and like what real life repercussions these characters have to face, when their history is kind of a little spotty, right? The holes that need to be filled in oftentimes. So yeah, so I think that's kind of what happens in Mexico in the book. So
what's so interesting, and I just want to very quickly say that I looked up some of the critical reviews of the book, The Sons of El Rey. By the way, if you come to the lecture, you'll be able to buy the book and get a signing from the author as well. So I mentioned that to you as an incentive to go on November the 17th. That's a Sunday at 2:30 to the Museum of Art. But some of the reviews, Publishers Weekly, of course, a very important review. Interwoven storylines, seamlessly interwoven. This is a knockout. It was the review, short and sweet. It was a knockout. Mm-hmm. And then other reviewers say, it has to do with the unmasking of the heart and the discovery of the human heart and the way the human heart carries through multi-generation regional trauma, et cetera. Classic, smart and smooth, big, rich human world. And it's talking about the novel being a body slam. How cool is that, Narciso? It's just fantastic. Let's see, another one that I was underlining here. The Secrets We Live Under the Cloak of Our Own Skin was another fantastic review from the Ramona Azabal, the author of The Last Animal. Ultimately is a tale about the country called Desire, was another review. that I thought, oh my gosh, that's such a beautiful way of putting it. And the idea of the body being the narrative, the body being the storyteller, the body being, you know, the epic structure. A lot of reviewers talked about that. It's talking about going through geography and time in some of the reviews. Let's see, another one I underlined, longing and loyalty and what that means. And here again, a lot of reviewers mentioned the use of the sensual and the conveyance of the sensual, in other words, the language of the body. Toxic masculinity was another reviewer's topic. I could go on and on. I have three pages of underlined reviews that I wanted to discuss with Alex. We just don't have the time today. But anyway, Richard, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I come back to my original question that Narciso answered so beautifully. I'm going to ask Alex the idea of breaking the cycle. How did Alex break the cycle? You know, that's the question we're going to come back to. Richard, let's go to quick break. Welcome back, and we could go on and talk to these two artists for quite a while, but I want to just get back to my original question. Alex Espinosa, how did you break the cycle?
Well, that's a good question. I think I broke it through literature, through reading and writing. I grew up in a big household. I'm the youngest of 11 children. And I didn't have my own bedroom. This was in the San Gabriel Valley here in Southern California. And my only means of escape and privacy was if I was reading. And that's kind of where I developed my need to interrogate the world around me and my need to question why people like me in my community had very limited choices in terms of what, you know, they would do once they finished high school. I started writing just to slow things down a little bit. What I was writing was very influenced by what I was reading. And at the time, in my high school curriculum, it was all, you know, old dead white guys, you know, in England, wearing tights and ruffs around their necks and in togas, you know, stabbing each other in the back and gouging their eyes out and marrying their moms. And so I started writing these really terrible short stories that were always set in England. And they always featured moats and fog. But the amazing thing that would happen is I would give these to my siblings to read, and they would actually stop what they were doing to read something that I wrote. And suddenly the world around us stopped for a second. And once it stopped, I was able to interrogate it. And I was able to sort of ask myself, why is it that, you know, I'm basically being set up to fail? My education, my culture, my community around me was basically setting me up to fail. I was this queer kid with a disability, so there was really nothing else I could do. The way I broke the cycle was basically by reading and writing, by knowing that I had the capacity and the ability to see the world in a way that nobody else around me could, right? And
I think that is fantastic, and I love it. I want to just one more shout out for you. I have to go Sunday, November 17th, two wonderful artists, Alex Espinosa and Narciso Martinez, talking about breaking the cycle and rewriting the story. And I love it, Alex, how you brought in the mythic right at the end there. It's like, okay, those togas did something for you. Thank you both. Thank you, Narciso. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Bye.
Looking forward to it, Alex.
Pleasure, likewise.